How many masks do we have yet today? Are there any masks to do? One, two. We have two masks. And how many paintings? Do we have any paintings to do? So just two masks. Okay, good. Almost all of the traditional self-development patterns initially were ways of expressing tradition. And in order to apply them from a tribal, traditional, cultural setting to the individual, they had to be reinterpreted so that the key quality in the reinterpretation was to find a transformational mode by which traditional language and traditional methods could be applied to the individual. And just for convenience sake, to make the distinction, the individual's growth concerns consciousness, not tradition. But part of the problem is that almost all of the wisdom traditions are traditional, almost to use a tautological form, so that almost all of the wisdom traditions had to be reinterpreted to apply to the individual as an individual, as a person who is trying to realize themselves rather than realize their place in the society, rather than realize their place in the tradition. This reinterpretation was extremely difficult, and it took about 500 years in terms of historical time to really complete it. And the time ran roughly from about 200 BC to about 300 AD. In those 500 years, human beings, our ancestors, in all traditions, struggled with how to make the interpretations apply to an individual. And what came out by the time of about 300 AD was really a strong sense of the person. The person as an individual who, in a conscious way, might assent to belonging to a tradition, but made a conscious choice and not just in a be wove into the traditional pattern. The language which tradition always used to do the weaving of the pattern was mythic. So that the mythologies were the traditional way by which an individual grew up. You grew up to be a part of the tribe, a part of this group, a part of this social scene. And even though there were sophisticated developments, like the weaving of many tribes together to form a larger collective, not just the 12 tribes of Israel and Judea, but Rome itself was a series of clans, families, that were woven together. The Julian clan, for instance. And Rome was a woven tribal society, after all. And the same thing was true of almost every traditional culture. They had been raised to an amplified level, but still in all, they were based on tradition. And they had a mythological language as their structure. What challenges tradition is history. History is a challenge to the traditional understanding. In a traditional understanding, you receive the stories of how such and so happened, and you pass them on, and that's what makes tradition, keeps it alive. But history is a different frame of reference. It's a different matrix. It, by nature, challenges tradition. Is this so? How can we find out? And even on an initial level, like the beginnings of history, Herodotus in Greece, about 400 BC, his way of dealing was to compare traditions. Here's what the Greeks say. Ah, but here's what the Persians say. Oh, but here's what the Egyptians say. And by comparing traditions, by comparative traditionality, Herodotus delivered the idea of history. He doesn't draw the conclusions, but allows the reader to see that there is a new perspective here, one of consciousness and not of tradition, not one of mythology, but one of history. But the problem is that the language of history is creative, because at its foundation, it is interpretive, not descriptive. This is a very important point, because normally someone will tell you that history is a description of what happened actually. History is based on facts. But this is a 19th century blindness carried on to the end of the 20th century, and still in a kind of an abject, moronic way, still kept alive in dead university systems. History is not based on fact. It is not a description of what happened. It is a creative interpretation of consciousness being derived out of a comparative traditionality. So that a large part of our problem in maturing in our lives, in our time, is exactly centered on the problems of history. All of the great struggles of the 20th century are nightmares of history. Marxism and its tremendous upheaval is an idea of history. The Industrial Revolution and capitalism, they are ideas of history. And so our lives have been spent in a world where the true adversaries are contending ideas of history. Individuals do not make war on the scale that has occurred in our lives. Only blind, vengeant gods parading as ideas make war on the scale of a whole planet, of whole populations of people. It is a nightmare of a misunderstanding of history that sends millions of people to their death because of a traditional value system which they withhold. And so the problem of trying to understand history is exacerbated for us. And when you come to the appreciation that I hope you come to in the next 3 months, that history for consciousness is a watershed. It is a transformational medium. And on one side of the transformational medium is the achievement of the person, of the individual, to express themselves. And however difficult it was, as you can well appreciate now, to be able to express yourself with some certainty, with some confidence, with some exactness. Nevertheless, that achievement is not the end. It's not the apex. It is only reaching the shore of a transformational ocean across which we must go. We must go to the other shore. And history is that oceanic turmoil which the individual faces. And we hope to get to the other shore, and on the other shore, we will find the spirit in, and in our time it comes out as science. It's a false historical idea to think that spirit and science are polarities, that they are at war. The warfare of science and religion is a false idea that comes from a mixed traditional misunderstanding of consciousness. It just simply is erroneous on many levels, on many scores. Part of the difficulty with the 20th century is that very few people were able to ever understand this, and very few were ever able to express it. And only since we have been alive, only in the last 50 or 60 years, has there been any real coming to terms with being able to understand what science is. And we, by now, by 1990, are in pretty good shape. Except that those who understand lead those who do not understand by a lag time of almost a century and a half. And the vast population that we have to deal with are languishing in a kind of regressive consciousness which is non-historical, and regressive by sliding back into a psychic state, a psychic medium, traditionally known as magic. So that the apparent polarity in terms of the world is between magic and science. And to throw away magic means that you undermine the ability of the person to come together in terms of themselves. And if you throw away science, you have a regression back, and one doesn't escape, one never does become oneself. So what I'm trying to express to you, we have plenty of time to try and understand all of this, is that there are problems which are tied into pretzels. And that if you tug on them, they're going to become knots. And the best thing to do is to let your sense of reaching conclusions be suspended for a while. All the time for the next 3 months, just let it be suspended and use as a talisman your sense of person that you have come to. Your sense of person, your idea of who you are, is your talisman. And it is a trustworthy talisman to carry on this navigating of the ocean of historical consciousness. With just that talisman made in the right way, you can navigate, you can make that journey. This is the tried and true conclusion and answer which our confrères and others in our time have painstakingly and painfully come to deliver to us. And it's a message of truth. The indispensable navigational tool is a sense of who you are. And if you have that, and you rely on that, you can make the transformation. You can cross the ocean of history and arrive at a spiritual science which you can trust, which will come out of you. The most fruitful beginning is to make a distinction between myth and history. And that distinction is largely one of kinds of language. So I'll read you something from our myth section from a year ago, and just refresh it in your minds and in your memories. Those of you who have tapes can go back. I think it was in the, I believe it was in the second or third of the myth tapes. You can Xerox copies of this if you wish. With a mythological horizon, one lives within the language forms. The language forms are not conscious. Here the meaning is content-oriented and feeling-toned. Interiorized meaning focuses into the symbolic vision. Here the forms of language are conscious and one is, quote, abstracted or, quote, transcended from the feeling-toned content somewhat. Deepen the integration and lessen the feeling content. More the tranquility of the deep self and the imageless. The image exists in language. Is that true? Yes. The image exists in language. Now you can think of a flow of language and the image as a kind of a world that's made by the current of that language, which if it gets tight enough, reflects light and becomes there. So images exist in language. We'll see when we get to Rilke today how beautifully he expresses this. For instance, if I say to you, let's slice a big juicy orange and open up the peel and let the wedges of the orange swing free. Notice the image exists in the language. The orange is nowhere in this room. The orange is actually nowhere in time. It exists in language, and however the temporal mode of the language is, that's where the image is. Yesterday, I sliced a big juicy orange. Tomorrow, we will slice an enormously juicy orange. You see, the image exists in the language, so that however the comportment of the language, that's where the image is. Now notice that if you have based your self-identity on an image base, no matter how strong the image base is, no matter how beautiful it is, no matter how awesome it is, your sense of self has no root and has no blossom, has no fruit. It is only an epiphenomenon of the language. So that language has to be transformed. And we'll find that magic language, as distinct from mythic language, is able to create. And the raising of the creation to a personal level of focus is the art. The difference then is not so much between a mythic language and a magic language as between a myth and poetry. Poetry is the ultimate magic language. So here we are. The image exists in language. Only when the mind is mythically subsumed can the mind be said to be mirror-like. Only when the mind is mythically subsumed can the mind be said to be mirror-like. language is the mirror. Notice that the image exists in language. We've talked about that. But notice then, one of the developments from that is that language is the mirror. That's how the image exists in the language. The mind, made of language, originally, mythically, is a mirror. Again, one of the qualities of a mirror is it cannot allow you to see the other side or through it. You can only see the imagery reflected in it. This is why a mind of mythicality has no self-conception whatsoever, has no ability to even self-conceive itself. It is not possible. So that the earliest discipline that one has to practice is silence. You have to stop the language, stop the mirror functioning, stop the image base from occurring. So that the very first discipline to self-discovery, the first transformational step, is silence. You have to turn the radio off in the mind. But it isn't like just turning the radio off in the mind. It's stopping the whole language comportment, which you have lived in since you were a child, in a very traditional way. This is a very difficult step to do because it doesn't seem like you're doing anything. Why? Because there are no images that are appropriate to that step at that time. What occurs to you is that I'm doing nothing. And of course, the image for that is any image that you have of uselessness. This is not an activity. This doesn't do anything. This doesn't lead anywhere. And your intuition is quite right. This activity does not lead to any objective image place. It leads to imagelessness. And instead of leading to things, like destinations or goals, it leads only to a pure sense of focus without anything being there. So now you can see that psychological counseling that's goal development will truncate a person's individuality and keep you forever wrapped into a closed loop and feed you back into traditional mythic horizons. You may have very complex traditions by this time, but you are wrapped up into a pretzel that would take almost a superhuman to break their way out of. Most of the people who are, quote, self-developed in our world at this time are pastiches of this kind of goal-oriented New Age psychology, where you're counseled into adjustment on a very sophisticated level. There is no reality in that realm at all. None whatsoever. And of course, because the mind cannot accept that, it flees from that or fights against that realization and seeks eventually, on a very desperate level, any other opportunity, any other possibility other than that. And this makes of one's deep self then a pit, that's the one place that one will not go. You get into the psychological condition of having a bubble inside, and there's no way that you can get rid of it, and there's no way that you can live with it. And so you, generally what happens in our time is that people opt for a kinetic kind of dynamism to cover up the fact that they don't have any equilibrium, like they can't be. And so their doingness, their constant speed, their constant proclivity at mobility and cleverness at opportunity and all of this is all a scam, essentially. And this is epidemic in our time. Almost the complete population is co-opted into this, in Hollywood we call it crap. Language is the mirror, mythology for the culture. In other words, the language becomes the mirror for the person, the nascent person. Mythology becomes the mirror for the culture. Mythology is the language form of tradition for the culture, for the group, for the tribe. When spoken language is symbolized, then written language is possible. So a mythic language is largely one that is spoken, so that you could use almost as a synonym for myth, the French word, I believe it's parole, speaking. But writing slips through the mythic speaking mode. And when you write something down, that written word is symbolic and not mythic. As soon as you write it down, it drops out of the mythic transformational media and objectifies as a symbolic deposit, as it were, so that the written word is an archetypal development. It's the first break in the mythic horizon, which until then you thought was all that there was. How could there be anything else than this? The written word, writing something, drops you out of this. Now, there's a wonderful presentation of this from High Consciousness that the Teacher of Righteousness put into the Book of Daniel, about 160 BC. The great Persian king, emperor, turns to look and sees God writing three words on the wall, as it were, right in front of him, many, many tekel. Those written words are the pulling of the plug of the whole psychic development, the whole ecology of traditional security. But he cannot translate those words. He cannot interpret those words. Daniel is brought in to interpret those words, because Daniel is the one who can see through the myth to the symbolic reality. And when he tells the meaning to the king, that's it. That whole confidence in that whole kingdom is finished. It's cracked. It's done. Not only the personality of the king is doomed, but the whole kingdom, the whole empire based on that is doomed. That whole worldview is shattered. It's like a fragile glass that as soon as you throw one little rock through it, the whole thing is shattered. And the Teacher of Righteousness is very, very capable, very competent of understanding that that's how you break an illusionary world. You just throw one symbolic rock as a true word through it, and it breaks the whole thing. Now, where the Teacher of Righteousness did that in a visionary, artistic way, the Book of Daniel is a work of art. Someone like Jesus does it personally in a life situation, throws himself through the illusion and shatters the whole Roman Empire, which is a weaving of tradition. The point here is that this activity is an activity which is archetypal of the structure of the way in which consciousness is born. The person as a conscious individual is born out of a previous worldview, which seemed all right, and for its limited purposes was certainly all right, but for any higher level of truth, for any deeper penetration of truthfulness, it's not all right at all. And one has to emerge from that. The whole sense, the feminine presentation of this activity is emergence. The best presentations of this psychologically for us, for Americans, is the Navajo. The Navajo emergence myths. The Hopi are versions of this also. But those emergence myths are meant not to stay in the myths, but to emerge from the mythic itself. It's very difficult to explain, but if you were to meet a traditional wise American Indian, they would be able to tell you the stories, tell you the myths, but to tell them to you from an artistic standpoint and not from a mythic standpoint. Whereas an anthropologist or a sociologist or a psychologist would hear them and hear them in a mythic way and think that they were telling myths, if you were there consciously, individually, in the existential present of the activity, you would see that the storyteller is not in the myth, but is delivering it as an artist delivers it. And can consciously stop at any point, can start at any point, is in control of the process and not subsumed under it at all. The whole process has been interiorized to such an extent that it's the person who is real, and the stories are not the support of the person. How is this so? In a very real way, to hear the stories is to be a child. To be able to tell the stories is to be an adult. It's a whole different process. You see the seeds in children when they're like about 5 years old. A little girl who's 5 years old, I go from my own experience. I used to tell my daughter stories, just all kinds of stories. The Ramayana, the Odyssey, all of the stories. And by the time she was five, she was telling stories to her dollies. It's a watershed. It's having passed a threshold. It's having come to a sense of person, even that young, five-year-olds already, have the seeds for that. And in a play mode can already develop a feel for it, which later on, it used to be with adolescence. It used to be with puberty that the transformation happens. Now we have a situation where there are 40-year-old girls and 40-year-old boys who still aren't mature. But being able to tell the stories is completely different from just being able to hear the stories. You have to hear them first, for sure. But to be mature, you have to be able to tell them. So here, the image exists in language. Only when the mind is mythically subsumed can the mind be said to be mirror-like. Language is the mirror, spoken language, and mythology for the culture is the mirror. When spoken language is symbolized, then written language is possible. The, quote, book displaces, quote, discourse. The book displaces discourse and assumes the mirror function for man and society. So the book then symbolically becomes the mirror, like the Bible is a holy book, or the Quran is a holy book, is the ultimate mirror in tradition, but it's only one little thin threshold away from the other side of that mirror, which is the individual emerging from that. The individual seeing that he is not that image, no matter how fantastically composite and satisfying it seems, but that he is other than that. So that with a symbolical vision present, and a symbolical vision initially is almost like a child's sense of play, you don't know that this is very important. You think that maybe you're daydreaming, or you think that, well, these thoughts are just occurring to me, or there's a sense of deja vu, or whatever it is. We don't understand initially that this is very important. And a pattern energy is beginning to play in us, and we're being lifted. We're being lifted out of where we were to some other place. So a symbolic vision, with a symbolical vision present, the thinking function develops out of the feeling function. You know the old saying, form follows feeling? The form is a thought idea. Thought, when it matures, matures out of feeling. So if you don't have any kind of comprehension about your feeling, your thought's not going to be very clear at all. Most people's thought function is so jumbled up that it's almost, for someone that can think clearly, it's almost painful to realize how crippled someone else is, because it is impossible for them to exercise that function. And ergo, how anxious they must be in their feeling function. And one feels compassion, rather poignant. The thinking function develops out of the feeling function, as it were. In the deep self-integration, in that tranquility, thinking and feeling are balanced, and neither claims our particular attention unduly. In the deep self, there's that equanimity between feeling and thinking. That's why the feeling is of tranquility. It isn't peace as in, like, well, I have a respite. It's a very high, clear, quiet. There can be this feeling or that feeling, but there doesn't need to be. There, you can think or you don't have to think. In other words, there's no compulsion. There's no magnetic drawing or pulling or pushing in any particular way. Both functions are there. Both functions are in perfect equilibrium. So that one can see in that kind of a condition, in a very high samadhi, that they are a single ribbon. It's a single continuity. Thought and feeling are not polarities, but it's like the old saw. If you take a ribbon and you turn it once, what was on the top before is on the bottom now. What's on the bottom before is on the top now. Thinking and feeling are like that. They have a complementarity. Jnana yoga is the practice of keeping that balance so that instead of having the full twist in the continuity of that function, you have like a half twist where it runs. The phrase razor's edge comes from that yogic quality, where thinking and feeling are both equally present all the time. And a real jnana yoga like Krishnamurti is a fantastic person to behold, because they are always balanced, completely balanced. They're not thought perfected, but it's feeling and thought held in exactly the same quality. Mr. Holland sometimes is very much like that. He's like a jhana yogi, keeping that exactly balanced. Yet with the coming of expression, the radiance of the self outward toward expressive forms, which at first are psychic energy, and in fact, they're occult symbolic forms, both characteristic of magic. So that at the very beginning, at the beginning of expression, there really are occult symbolic forms, which are psychic energy configurations. They really are. The essence of magic is the essence of psychic feeling configurations. For instance, in the Vajrayana, which is the most sophisticated magical practice on the planet, in the Vajrayana, in order to have a effective magical ritual, one first has to create the configurations, and great care is taken to create, the Tibetan word for them is torma. One creates the configurations that you want to use, and then you bring them together and apply them. But all the great teachers in the Vajrayana, all the really great teachers in the Vajrayana, like the Dalai Lama, will tell you what to make with these configurations is your selflessness. Not to make rain fall on the bad people and hail and all that. Not to make lightning strike down somebody who pissed you off. All of that is extreme. The thing that one makes with the psychic configurations is to bring the selflessness of the person. That is to say, to make the person, but to make the person open. That the winds of the spirit can blow through. So this can be misinterpreted, and largely because of the difficulties in handling this in most teachers, magic is left out or put on the back burner, as it were. For instance, if you go to the PRS, all of the magic books are upstairs in a separate room, and all the really powerful ones are in the vault, locked away. Yes, they're there. Yes, they're important, but no, you can't see them today. That sort of thing. So with the coming of expression, with the coming out from the deep self, and if you go into a symbol of this, the symbol that initially comes is that one has become a sun. A sun in the sense that something in you, an interior star sometimes, is radiating. What is it radiating? It's radiating the invisible energies of expression, and those radiant waves are the very materia out of which the psychic configurations come. The earliest expression of this is the Egyptian symbols that every ray of the sun has a little ankh on the end of it. The ray of the sun is not just a ray of light going, but it's the movement of life force that is occurring. So that the sun shining delivers not so much light, but life. Its movement is light, but its reception is life. So that if you are open to receive, you will receive life. If you're closed, you'll just reflect the light, and the life will go elsewhere, leaving a dead zone behind the mirror. So somebody who has very sophisticated, clever, mythic mind ends up being a fantastically secure dead zone. Wonderful. And for that, you get to tour all the places of the world and see just how people did this even so much more. Sorry for the cynicism, but sometimes it gets a little much living on this planet. Now, thought claims attention and feeling is subsumed and appears more and more subconscious. In other words, it's like turning that ribbon. Before, thought was like subconscious, and now feeling becomes subconscious, tends to be, unless, of course, you're very sophisticated at this, like a jnana yoga, and can keep it in balance.